So last time we looked at the symmetries in general and in particular of our first order formulation, and we found that there are gauge symmetries, and in the discussion about the Noether theorems, we concluded that we should expect kind of constraints in an initial value formulation. Now, initial value formulation is basically canonical formalism. And that what we will do are we will basically do a canonical analysis of our of our 3D first order action. And that's not only to do this analysis, but canonical formulation allows us to do canonical quantization, as you can guess. And the canonical in the canonical formulation, it's most clearly defined what are observables and what are degrees of freedom and so on. And so you can actually consider many conceptual questions. Because so far, theory of measurements and so on are best defined in the canonical formalism. That doesn't mean it's the only one, but let's go through this. Okay. So let's bit review the basics. So you have given an action, and usually it depends on just first time derivatives. And then we can basically rewrite this action with a Lagrangian function. As we hope to rewrite it. As this expression, where this is a Hamiltonian, of course. And here you have PQ dot, where you introduced functions P of Q and Q dot, which are called the momenta. And so these are defined as the partial derivatives of this Lagrangian with respect to time, to Q dot, to the time derivative of Q. And usually you hope that, in fact, that you can solve these. Uniquely, as function of Q dot of Q and P. Okay, so these are Q dot that defines the momenta, and then you hope that you can solve these things. And in this case, you would basically get a bijection basically between the initial data Q dot and QP. Now, as you know, the canonical formalism allows you to basically write the equation of motion in different forms. Let me check what. So the nice thing, it defines a symplectic structure. And that's defined if P is the derivative of L with its corresponding velocity, then I use the convention that the Poisson bracket of Q and P is 1. And this actually can be extended to a Poisson structure between arbitrary functions, phase space functions f and g. And so you get this thing. And if you have more variables, you have to put indices everywhere. And I hope you are slightly used to these things. Minus df. Okay, so let's assume so what we have there on the left hand side is something like a second order action L Q Q dot, and we can rewrite this. The L vanished. Oh. I suppose no. There's this L. We rewrote that just into some different variables, but if you understand P as a function of Q and Q dot, you get exactly the same as on the left-hand side. But now what we can do, and that's the same as we did in gravity, we can understand the P just as independent variables. And so let's take now an action which would be a different action because now it's a functional of two things, namely before it was this S was just a functional of trajectories in Q. Now this is a function of a priori trajectories in Q and P. And we take this P Q dot minus h, where now actually this only works if you in fact can solve q dot for p and q. Oh no, actually this is still sorry. So this is really p q dot minus h p q. dt. And we can ask, okay, let's do a canonical analysis of this thing. And we would define the momentum conjugated to P. And I can basically write it now as a variational derivative of this action with respect to Q dot. And so Q dot only appears here. So I get momentum conjugated to Q in this action is P. So that's nice. It's consistent with the previous expression. And I can try to figure out what is the momentum conjugated to P. Variational derivative of this action with respect to P dot. What do we do?
Minus Q.
Yeah, so indeed. So it's not zero. You have to actually do integration by parts here. So you have to be always careful. If you don't find a Q dot, you have to check whether any integration by parts can't give you a Q dot. And so in fact, you get minus Q dot. And so again, that is completely consistent also with the minus sign if you figure out what the symplectic structure is and you put everything. Sorry, minus Q. then in fact, here you get that I hope it's now consistent. This is supposed to be minus one, because I have first the momentum, and that's consistent with minus Q P being minus one. Okay, so we see we can always I mean, we can always replace our second order action with the first order action. And that's actually what happened in gravity, just without being explicit in introducing momenta. okay. And let's, in general, again, that is now holds in general that the symplectic structure or the time evolution, you can really rewrite the equation of motion in the Lagrangian formalism into equation of motion for the Hamiltonian formalism. And as you know, you can do that via these Poisson brackets. And you get a complete system by looking at these two. And actually, this will allow you to get the time evolution of any function, f, phase-space function, as the Poisson bracket of this phase-space function, f with h. And the solution of the thing, so actually you can go on and say, if I can take, if I can find in this way the time derivative of any phase space function, then what is the time derivative, what is the second time derivative of this phase space function?
With
yeah.
H.
I take this expression and do a dot over the thing. So that is a like the double bracket. And so you can go on. And so what the solution, the time evolution of the phase space function f is given by the Taylor expansion. And what I have defined here are these repeated Poisson brackets, where h appears r times and f just once. yeah. And here you have, of course, to be careful in how you interpret that thing. So this is a time evolution of a phase space function f. And here you will get lots of, basically, it's an expression q and p. And these q and p on the right hand side, you have to interpret them as initial values. okay, and obviously you can actually take any phase space function. So this is defined to be the flow of f under a phase space function which happens to be called h. Of course, you could take any phase space function and figure out what is the flow under this phase space function. so we see that actually any phase space function generates a flow. Okay, so that's basically the basics of phase space which we need. And now we have to go to actually gravity. And as I told you, it's basically canonical analysis is about initial value formulation. So what you are usually interested in is that you have your manifold M. What is it called? And then you have an equal time surface. So So the point will be that, of course, what is what time is, it's a bit arbitrary, you have to define it. So this equal time surface will be often called sigma. And what one usually wants to have is again a bijective map between solutions which you can put here and the initial data here. And so in fact the question is, what are the initial data? And do they give us a unique solution or not? And what do these initial data need to satisfy? And basically, these initial data, they define you the number of degrees of freedom. This is the amount of free initial data you can choose. Modulo non-uniqueness in the solutions you will encounter. And so what you have seen so far mostly, except in Young-Mills, is where it was easy to get this map. And the phase space is exactly there to get you this map. And we will see in the case of gravity, because of symmetries, there are lots of subtle issues arising there. And so what we will do is actually, we will make our life simple. We will say that M is again sigma Kreutz cross some cross R. So R is topologically the time direction. And we will choose adapted coordinates. I mean, one can do that in a more complicated way, but the result will be the same. Adapted coordinates, which means that sorry. I use, instead of mu, I will use zero for the time direction and A for the spatial directions. And x0 constant will be indeed my equal time surfaces. Okay, so we take our action which we found, and actually I drop a minus sign and introduce a 1/2 to be consistent with some other conventions which now arise. So that is a case you are wondering, it's a slightly changed action. so that doesn't change anything at the equation of motion. So we had the gravity action basically as EF. So this is E, this is an F. It's all contracted. And we had this Levi-Civita tensor, which is a tensor density, which I write sometimes with a tilde, sometimes not. Okay, and so what we have to do, so this is our action. And what we want to do is a canonical analysis in the same way as we did above. And what we did there also is a one-dimensional context, so there's not much to decide, is that we actually isolated the time derivatives. So what we have to do is to isolate the time derivatives. Because these will define what the momenta are. So I just actually put really the replace these indices mu by zero and a. to see what happens. And then the other thing, which should be probably here somewhere, is that I can define a two-dimensional Levi-Civita as, and I think it's this way, the three-dimensional Levi-Civita with one index set to zero, and it's the left index. Yeah. And so AB only goes from 1 to 2, and so I have just a two-dimensional Levi-Civita tensor. Okay, so here I basically already try to isolate the time derivatives. And what one had to remember actually is the definition of the curvature tensor, which we had some time ago. And the curvature tensor was, in particular, was anti-symmetric. So there's only one component F0A. And this is F0A, that is basically that's also what I remember. So only F0A will include any time derivatives acting on the connection, and that will give me only this term and this as a time derivative. The other thing is a spatial derivative. And what you have to do to what you did here to rewrite this term, because it appears here, is to do an integration by part. And as you can see, the spatial derivative ends up actually on the triad connection. And then the other stuff is just a collection of all terms. So there's obviously also a term which where both indices are spatial. This is this term. If both indices are spatial, then the third index in this Levi-Civita tensor has to be zero. So that gives you this term. So this gives you FAB. At this term, and F0A gives you on the one hand this term, which comes from here, and all the other stuff here gives you this term. So actually, we only find one time derivative. It's this one, and via integration by parts, is again, it's basically also this one. But this, you know, was exactly like our PQ dot term before. So we basically find that these two terms are canonically conjugated modulo this epsilon. So Momente are conjugated to the spatial part of the connection. Of course, I could write it this way. So this defines me. They're called EAJ for good reason, because I told you it's all a bit connected to Young-Mills theory, and the Young-Mills theory has some electrical fields, which are basically the same as electrical fields you know from Young, from electrodynamics, just that there's an additional index J. And so this is defined as a variation of the action with respect to the time derivatives of the spatial components, or if you want to be fancy, the pullbacks to the spatial hypersurface of the connection. And so it's almost this little e, just that we also have this 2D Levi-Civita tensor here. And so you find this expression. And if I would take the canonical, if I would ask for the canonical variable conjugated to the little e's, I would basically find an expression which would give me something like epsilon tilde AB contracted with A, so that I get consistent Poisson brackets. So basically, I find that Poisson brackets, so these things are exactly conjugated to each other. And now x and y here, I should have called them with some different name, but these are 2D variables now. and so I have conical deltas djk, DEB, there's no symmetrization, and I have a conical, I have a delta function, xy. So technically, there's always a thing. I wrote it here. That this is actually density, which is kind of comes from having this Levi-Civita tensor here. And it's consistent that this delta function is always a density in one entry. So this has to be remembered if you want to write expressions which are invariant under spatial diffeomorphisms, whether you have to put something determinant of a matrix there or not. So that's the one canonical pair we found. It's basically that the spatial components of the triads and the spatial components of the connection are conjugated to each other. So that's nice, but a priori, we have more variables in our system, and so we can ask what happens with these variables. And so we indeed find that, I mean, we could try to define our momenta conjugated to E0J, and we would find zero. So actually, that would be already some kind of constraint, but it's so trivial that the we jump over the step, and the same holds for A0J. However, we said also the other thing is that we could actually already look at the equation of motion. So here we haven't even, we don't even need to rewrite the action into canonical, I mean, basically it's already rewritten into canonical variables, because we only found these as canonical variables. And so we found that, that there are no momenta conjugated to E0J and A0J. however, E0J and A0J still appear in the action. And they appear linear in the action. So actually, if I I can vary my action with respect to E0j. And that gives me actually an equation of motion. And in this case, it gives me, I have defined it. Let's write it here. It gives me exactly the term in front of this E0j. And in fact, how it acts is it acts as Lagrange multiplier, because the action is just linear in these fields. And so varying the action with respect to Lagrange multiplier enforces a constraint, and that is this constraint. The constraint tells you that the spatial components of the curvature have to vanish. And we discuss the equation of motion, which says that the curvature has to vanish. So we actually find a subset of the equations of motion as constraints. And these are constraints, however, on the initial data. So f j a b is just a function of the spatial components of our connection, so there's no time component appearing, as you can check. Let me maybe write the definition. So there's an antisymmetrization, which already is in AB. And you see that there are no time components of the connection. So this indeed is a constraint. It's called curvature constraint for obvious reason. On phase-based variables, okay. And it has to be satisfied, obviously, if we want to evolve the data and find a solution, then, in fact, these are part of the equation of motion. So this constraint has to be satisfied for kind of consistent initial data. Otherwise, you can't evolve it into a solution. So this was this part. And then I nicely isolated you this part. So this is an epsilon. So that's also a Lagrange multiplier. And so that gives you this other thing. See, another constraint. And that turns out, if you check what is the definition of the torsion, to be exactly, again, the spatial components of the torsion. Which apparently, for some reason, is also an antisymmetric tensor. So let me say that contracting this with a Levi-Civita tensor here, with a 2D Levi-Civita tensor, still gives you all spatial components, because there's only one spatial component for an antisymmetric tensor. So that's exactly what is there in terms on the left-hand side. And again, I don't need to write the antisymmetrization because it's contracted with something antisymmetric. And so this is also constrained. And this, I mean, you can call it the torsion constraint. But in fact, this is a constraint which also holds in Young-Mills theory. And it's called the Gauss constraint. And it's the same thing, which it's the same as the Gauss equation, which says that the divergence of the electrical field has to vanish. Completely wrong here. So I take this expression and rewrite my little epsilon. Rewrite the little e's into the electrical fields e's. And then I get the Gauss constraint, because I just wrote a And in fact, from electrodynamics, that you know the equation that the divergence of the electrical field vanishes. And that's the case where you are in an abelian theory and you have no index here. So it's exactly the same kind of equation. And here you have a non-abelian theory. And so you have actually this additional term. Okay, so that's the Gauss constraints, which we have. And so we find that our canonical formulation is given in terms of a phase space. Where the only fields we have is actually the spatial pullbacks of the connection and the triads. And furthermore, we basically have the curvature constraint and the Gauss constraint. And so this would actually give us the allowed initial data. So it's very different from taking all fields and just, you know, evaluating them on a hypersurface, because firstly, we don't have these Lagrange multipliers. They don't matter. I mean, they will turn out to be gauge parameters, as we will see. And secondly, we have in addition these constraints, which have to hold for these variables. Okay. And these two constraints, they form the constraint hypersurface and phase space, which is the hypersurface and phase space where these two equations are satisfied. So it's not just one equation, but it's lots of equations. And in fact, one could count the number of equations which you have. And you can count the number of variables and the number of constraints, and you will find the same number. And so in fact, that is again a sign of a topological field theory, that on the face of it, you seem to get no degrees of freedom. But in fact, there will be finitely many degrees of freedom left over, because we usually count here. It's basically the number of components times infinity for each spatial point. And then what can be left over in this kind of counting is the finite number of degrees of freedom. Okay, let's, oh, yeah.
Your last constraint should, an expression that equates to
So, it doesn't equate to zero, it has to equate to zero. Okay, so this at least, we specified the allowed initial data. And the other thing what we need is actually what we had here, the Hamiltonian, which gives us the time evolution. And yeah, you should remember the thing which I am just erasing. And compare it with the thing which is now very upstairs. So here there was a term PQ dot minus H. So we are a bit lazy and just say, okay, by analogy, I have an H, which is everything to the right of the thing. Okay, so for some reason there's a minus sign because I have a plus there, and there was a minus here. And then I use the expression which I defined on this other blackboard. So this thing multiplying this Lagrange multiplier, time component of the triad, this is a curvature. And then I have this other time component of the connection, which is also a Lagrange multiplier, multiplies the Gauss constraint. And so we find that the Hamiltonian is a sum where sum, I mean sum in the sense of includes also integrals, it's just a sum over constraints. So the Hamiltonian itself vanishes, and that's one of the puzzling features. It's not so puzzling, but it's one of these funny features of general relativity. So maybe I say here, this is without boundary. And so in case you would have hoped that the canonical formalism gives you a notion of energy, because it's hard to define covariantly. But here you also find that the Hamiltonian has to be zero, so energy has to be zero. And in fact, it's that the gravitational part, in a sense, even if you have matter, has always a negative energy, which cancels the positive energy of the matter part. Okay, so the Hamiltonian is a sum over constraints. And in fact, usually these systems are called totally constrained systems. Which are usually misspelling systems. And in fact, we could have guessed it. I mean, we will see that basically every gauge symmetry leads to a constraint and will generate these constraints will generate the evolution which corresponds to this gauge symmetry. And so time translations are also gauge symmetries in GR because they are just a special form of diffeomorphisms. And so they are, in fact, they are generated by a constraint, which happens to be this Hamiltonian constraint. So now, actually, these things here are completely arbitrary functions. I mean, they will become, they will get an interpretation in the final solution. But in fact, these are a priori in this Hamiltonian formalism arbitrary functions. And so they, I think, I just called it capital NJ. So it's a so-called Lagrange multiplier, and that will be called a lambda J. And so one can define the Smith constraint G lambda. That's a and so that's the Smith Gauss constraint. And you have a smeared curvature constraint, NG, FG, D2X. So these things are usually a bit better defined than the pointwise objects. and these smeared constraints have, of course, to be satisfied for all choices of lambda and N. Yes, I didn't. So in fact, now the Hamiltonian is the sum over constraints. We could indeed be interested in figuring out what this constraint actually does generate. It does generate time evolution. But these things were completely arbitrary. And so here we can actually choose arbitrary Lagrange multipliers and get a priori different solutions. By the way, don't be confused. The Hamiltonian needs to be zero. Nevertheless, it can generate something, a flow. And this flow is our time evolution. and so let's check what do these things generate. And so we will basically, in fact, it's easier to start with the Gauss constraint. And we will recognize, you guys will immediately recognize the stuff which we had discussed yesterday. So we will now consider the infinitesimal variation of this flux variable under the flow generated by the Gauss constraint. So that means I need actually to consider, as we said in the beginning of this lecture, the Poisson brackets of this expression with the smeared Gauss constraint. And actually, here you see one reason. Actually, not yet, but in general, you will see one reason why it's good to smear the Gauss constraints or any constraint. It's a lengthy expression, but in fact, this flux commutes, Poisson commutes with everything which is a flux. And the only thing it does not Poisson commute is with A. And so if you have not seen that these Poisson brackets, they would commute with the integral. So it doesn't see the lambda, doesn't see this thing. So it would be basically just this part. And so you would basically just write this Poisson bracket EAJX, and here you have an ELBY, and would use this expression there. provided as a data function, and Kronecker symbols. And so with all signs and everything, you will find EGMK, EEM, lambda kx. So the appearance of this Levi-Civita tensor in the internal indices might remind you of something. Which we discussed yesterday. Okay, yesterday we had it with little ease, but now we can replace everything with the flux variables. And so we discussed this as an infinitesimal variation of the co-triads under an internal rotation, which would be defined by these parameters lambda k. And so, in fact, yeah, I didn't mention, but of course, we just replaced omega with A at some point, also because everybody is doing that. So A is usually what you use in Young-Mills gauge theories. And so in a canonical analysis, that is usually called A. And omega in a covariant context, or actually if you really do gravity. So then you can consider also the infinitesimal variation of A, and you expect to find the same result, namely that in fact that does internal generates internal rotations. And so let me write this. Of course, you have to consider something. So here you see now that it's good to smear the constraints, because now A does not commute with many of these variables. In particular, it would not commute with this expression. And so what you have to do is either to learn to deal with these things, or you do always a partial integration onto your parameter, smearing parameter. So that you just have the Poisson bracket of here now A with E, and you know what to do. So here I basically write already the form where one would do the partial the integration by parts. And so now you have this constraint in a form where you can again apply the same rule. So you will get two terms, one from here. You see that you expect the derivative lambda k there. One from here, so this will kill, sorry, this term. And you are left with derivative of lambda plus ejlm. E-L-E, lambda M. And in fact, if you compare your notes, in case you have these, from yesterday and replace A with little omega, you see it's exactly the same formula we found for an infinitesimal internal rotation. And so we see, in fact, that the Gauss constraint generates internal rotations, and these internal rotations are nothing else than the usual Young-Mills gauge symmetries, gauge transformations. So in fact, it's a thing which generates a Young-Mills gauge transformation. Okay, we can do the same exercise with it will not work. With the flatness constraints. And let me give here the results. So the variation of E with respect to the flatness constraint. Okay, the flatness is something in the curvature, it's something in the connection, and there are derivatives of the connection. So you have to do all the same tricks, which we had here. and you will find, since the curvature has a derivative of a connection, you will find one derivative which acts on the Lagrange multiplier, plus there's this other term with an epsilon and the connection itself. And the Lagrange multiplier. And this you should also immediately recognize. Okay, maybe you recognize it after we wrote this. So what could this be? So this will be vanishing because the connection commutes with the curvature. And we had this yesterday as a translation. Symmetry. And so you might be wondering, because I said, hey, you say the Hamiltonian should give us a time evolution, and time evolution is a diffeomorphism, so where is the diffeomorphism? But then, in fact, remember the last lecture where we said we can write the diffeomorphisms on shell as combinations of translations and rotations. And so, in fact, what you have to do, and I gave you the formulas, you know, you have, in fact, to use these formulas, which give you now the Lagrange multipliers, in fact, in terms of these things. And you will exactly find the same formulas, because I said nj has to be chosen as a diffeomorphism times the triad. So if you say the time evolution is just in the zero component, you will exactly find this. So it's completely consistent. of course, I ignored all signs, which could go wrong. And however, it's much easier to deal with this form than with the diffeomorphisms, because if you would like to express something which really generates diffeomorphisms, that would end up in coefficients here, which would be phase space dependent, and that will lead to certain difficulties. You can do that. It's a nice exercise to do that. And you get a much more complicated algebra of constraints. And so that's what we will discuss next time, because this algebra of constraints is quite important, because what we have to do classically, we would have to solve for all constraints. Quantum mechanically, we would also need to solve for all constraints. However, Poisson brackets of constraints, for instance, are get hopefully converted into commutators of constraints. And so if you think, you know, can you find a zero solution to something which has a non-vanishing commutator between two things which has a non-vanishing commutator, then the answer is typically you can't, because There's an uncertainty relation, which goes, does prevent this. And so this algebra of constraint is important to discuss anomalies, or to actually avoid anomalies. And so we will shortly go through that. And then I will shortly explain you what general constraint quantization is, which I will only do with these simple examples. And then we, I think, yeah, we go on to quantization. Okay. Thank you.